I'm Karen Budd. I'm the class of 84, and Jeff asked me to make a few introductory comments. It's really an honor for me to say a few words about Suzanne, who is one of the most impressive women that I know, honestly. But to keep it real, and you'll hear how impressive she is, I have to share some texts that we exchanged about 3 hours ago. So Suzanne has a very full plate, as you all know, and she texts me this morning, "I messed up and booked my flight for 10:25 p.m. today instead of a.m. I'm a total wreck." I said, "Deep breaths." And she said, "Either that or write my talk." I said, "Don't worry about it." She said, "I didn't have time to pack, so I brought 4 sets of shoes." Does that? Who does it? Who does that crazy shit? Trick question, the answer is me. Say hi to your mom. So, Suzanne, you're among friends. While we were classmates at Amherst, we didn't really meet each other until our junior year when we both were on the same program in Kenya. And that's when I really got to see Suzanne and see her element, like with animals, her passion, and her ease with just the wildlife. After Suzanne, for those of you who haven't followed her career, which probably most of us in our class have, Suzanne earned her veterinarian degree from Tufts University. She did a surgical internship and then a residency in zoological medicine at the Smithsonian's National Zoo, where she went on to become the National Zoo's chief veterinarian from 2001 to 2014. Suzanne currently serves, and we'll be talking about, as the director of the Global Health Program and chief wildlife veterinarian medical officer at the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute, leading a global team and worldwide efforts to address health and endangered wildlife and working to combat global infectious disease. Over the years, I've seen Suzanne add to her innate love of animals with vast knowledge, amazing experience, a grueling global travel schedule, lectures, publications, and all her incredibly hard work has earned her recognition as a global leader. And all this accomplished while raising 3 amazing kids, Grant and her twins, Jamie and Evan. And while Suzanne and I don't get to see each other often enough, these days our communication is mostly around texts and focused on what to binge watch next. I feel really honored to count Suzanne as one of my dearest friends. And Suzanne, you're among friends. Your shoes look great. You could talk about anything and you'll be entertaining and informative. So it's an honor to introduce Suzanne.
It's really great to see everybody. Thank you for the intro. And it's true, look, I've never been a shoe person. That's why I can't decide. I'm like, this pair. But when I was trying to figure out what to talk to you guys about, things have changed in veterinary medicine so much. Things have changed in my life. And I was trying to figure out, what's more interesting, hearing about a zoo vet, some of the wildlife work we've done. I sought counsel from 2 friends. One, like, I called Amanda Moretti and said, "What do you think?" And she said, "Well, I mean, why don't you just say that zoo medicine has changed so much and that maybe there's a smattering you can tell the story arc of that." And I'm like, that's actually a really great idea. And the other friend I texted for, payback's a bitch, the other person I asked for was Karen. And she said, "Why don't you give that talk on animal penises?" Right? So be careful what you dish out, sister. And I could have sworn it was at your dad's Thanksgiving when we were talking, because, like, pigs have a corkscrew-shaped penis and females have a corkscrew-shaped vagina. I mean, like, who would have thought of that? So anyways, in and of itself, that can be quite entertaining. I'm going to go with Amanda's suggestion, so thanks for that, though. Perhaps the next time. So, all right, so anyways. Most of us who are veterinarians have known since we were 5 that that's what we wanted to do. Gyle Clancy, she and I both were thinking the same thing. We both came to Amherst knowing which was where our direction was heading. So it's kind of nice because I never had to go through that introspection of, like, what do I want to do with my life? So that part is good. So anyways, I always knew I wanted to be a wildlife vet. And what I didn't really quite anticipate was the field, or the way things would change, and the way we'd be more involved in a global setting, and the way we'd be looking to get involved in human medicine as well. So first, just in terms of, to set the stage, what it's like to be a vet in the zoo, a lot of it is just clinical care of individuals, which but you know, some of the most threatened individuals in the planet, like Micronesian kingfishers. There are like 65 of them in the world. So if you're, and they're only like, you know, 70 grams. So if you're drawing a blood sample, or anesthetizing, when like you really don't want to be the person who messed up and, you know, like killed the 70th Micronesian kingfisher. But it's a great opportunity to learn, and I would say that never a day goes by where we're not learning about something, and which is why I tend to put too much on my plate and then send these crazy texts or book my flight for 10 o'clock at night, so 10 in the morning. Anyways, residencies in zoo medicine are very much a study in diversity, going from species to species and trying to learn the difference in anatomy between a Komodo dragon or a panda or a caracal. It's really, really super fascinating, but it's a little bit time consuming, as you might imagine. Physical exam components and what we do when we're looking at an animal is very similar to what you would do dog and cat medicine or human medicine. You know, you do a thorough history. In veterinary medicine in particular, it's really important to do the history because you need to understand from the keepers, the people who are taking care of these animals, have animals been acting, eating, behaving, and then we go through everything else once an animal is anesthetized, including physical exam and blood work, getting chemistries, and then using a lot of the same diagnostic modalities that are used in human medicine as well. One of the big differences is anesthesia varies a lot species by species, so you have to think what's your best way of getting your hands on the animal without, one, you getting hurt or a person getting hurt, or without hurting the animal as well. So we do think a lot about the size. You know, is it bigger than a bread basket, smaller? I mean, can you get a net over it? How do you catch it? What is the animal's defense mechanism? So like an eagle will have claws, you don't want to get hurt by that. You know, certainly venomous snakes. Cassowaries. Does anybody know what a cassowary is?
Yes.
What do you know about a cassowary?
So this guy in Florida had a cassowary.
Yes.
That he kept, and he had a bunch of wild animals.
Yeah.
And he fell into the enclosure.
And he killed him.
Jumped up and killed him with the claw.
Yeah, exactly that, right? Yeah. So cassowary.
So it's like an ostrich kind of? It's a bird.
Yeah, go with it. Yeah. Yeah, and they don't know, not only that, but they've got these long legs, and they have like these three toes. The middle one's super sharp, so like, you know, and then but they're tall enough so they can just slice you, and that's what they do. They go right for the jugular. Yeah, so you know, and so you have to think about if you're going to get your hand on an animal, how are you going to get it, not hurt anybody, not hurt yourself, not hurt the animal. And the mode of anesthesia differs for animal to animal. Amphibians, for instance, have porous skin, so if we want to anesthetize them, we can drop something like tricaine or novocaine that's balanced for pH onto their skin and they go asleep. I mean, you can give too much, right? So you have to be careful about that. And you can also not give enough, and that's always a trick with different species, because if you're working with something large and it wakes up on you, that's not the best thing in the world. And some animals can really trick you, too, and they're so used to being darted that as soon as something hits them in the butt, they go to sleep, and then you come up on them, and they're like, you know, which has happened. My old boss reminded me that we lived in Texas for a while, and I was pregnant with Grant, 8 months pregnant, and we darted a chimpanzee, and we're all sitting there. I'm like, she looks asleep to me. Like, yeah, so I said, give me your broom. And I went into the enclosure and poked her, and she stood up and she grabbed the broom and was chasing me around. I had forgotten that story because I was really fat and I couldn't run that fast. And so anyways, there's lots of funny things like that. So I try and keep animals a little bit deeper under anesthesia, but other people, you know, do different things. All right. So anyways, there's different ways of getting your hands on animals. For animals that are far away, we use things like darts and dart guns, so there's a lot of training that's involved in that. Things like giraffe, elephant, rhino, we anesthetize them with something called ultra-potent narcotics. So it's about 80,000 times more potent than morphine. So if you get a drop in your eye and your mucous membranes, you have between like 60 and 120 seconds before it's a complete cardiac arrest. So that's not so good either. So especially if you're working in like in the middle of China, like 4 days away from the nearest town. So we have a lot of safety protocols that we go through. Safety is always first, so there's a lot of training involved in that. Once animals are under anesthesia, they don't look all that different. They look somewhat different than people, I imagine. But so we have an endotracheal tube in that helps us maintain the level of anesthesia. And veterinary medicine, particularly zoo medicine, is a lot about modifying. So we borrow a lot from human medicine, but we also make stuff up along the way to make it work. For instance, this snake, it's being intubated, so a tube goes into the trachea. But the tube that we're using is actually an IV catheter. So an IV catheter that would be used for a human is really small, and it's a nice way of getting in there. The other thing important about this is you'll see a spatula. So if you're trying to get a snake down under anesthesia, they don't do so well with absorbing intramuscular. You're better off getting them gas anesthesia. But you can't get their mouths open with that. Sometimes you can use a credit card, but that can break their teeth. We don't want to hurt the animal. Spatulas work really well, so we can kind of get their mouth open, get the endotracheal tube in. So again, a lot of it's just, you know, learning, always learning, and trying to find ways of adapting. Oh, good, the person I...
You're so hard to find.
No, I actually gave you a shout-out for having some good ideas about, you know, what I should speak about, as opposed to Karen, who thought I should talk about animal penises. So we went through that part real quick. So we use a lot of the same modalities, x-rays, MRI, blood work, ultrasound, a lot of the same things that we do in human medicine. And we also have a lot of the same subspecies. So after you do an internship, when you graduate from vet school, you can go and practice. You can do an internship to specialize a little bit more, and you can do a residency to specialize even more. And some of the residencies are things like cardiology or soft tissue surgery or dentistry. And you might think, how different is one tooth from another? They're really, really different. The difference between the snake teeth, giant pandas have canines that go their whole way through the back of their jaw, which is really important because if you're trying to do a root canal, you don't want to drill just down. You have to drill the whole tooth out. So there's people who know all this going from species to species. So dentition is really a thing. Cardiology is a big issue with great apes. Leading cause of death in gorillas is heart disease. I'll talk about that in a minute. All right, so part of it, one of the great things about being a zoo vet is we have a chance to take primary care of individuals again, and that's a really great honor to be able to take care of some of the most endangered animals in the world, without a doubt. And that's where, from a young age, I knew that's what I wanted to do. But there's also an opportunity after you're doing that for a while to think, we can expand that and we can actually help more than just individuals. We can think about helping groups, populations, and then species in general. So in the next, and really one of the great ways of doing that is through research, and it's one of the things that's really great about Smithsonian. Zoos are really expensive to run, and your average zoo does not have the resources to do a lot of research, and one of the great things about being part of Smithsonian and the whole mission to increase and diffuse knowledge is that we're supposed to be looking and researching, figuring out why, and publishing and sharing this information. So that's what we do, and it's been really great. So that's what right now I'm thinking more about going from individuals to populations, and in captivity and in the wild. One of the things that our team does now, as we've expanded, we work with a number of different countries, but still within the zoo, some of the things that we're looking into is cardiac disease in gorillas. So in human medicine, leading cause of death, but it tends to be more coronary in nature, where the vessels become affected and related to diet and exercise. In great apes, it's different in that it's fibrosing cardiomyopathy, and that's where fibrous tissue gets laid down in the walls of the muscle, and it blocks the electrical impulse. So an animal's doing fine until it's not, until that impulse does not go through. Since it is a leading cause of death, it's one of the things we want to look at. So we borrow from human medicine. And then there's groups of other zoos around the country that might be involved as well. In this case, we have a group of leaders, half MDs volunteering their time, half vets volunteering their time, looking at the Great Ape Heart Program. There's a number of different things, including establishing normal values for ultrasounds. Like if you're an MD, right, and you know what those normals are because you have millions, hundreds of thousands of normal images from what you know, for over the last decades, you know, of what human hearts should look like. Gorilla hearts are a little bit different. This is a still frame of an ultrasound. It turns out, and what before we had many people in veterinary cardiology looking at gorilla hearts, we did have humans, MDs. we had MDs come over and partner with us, and they would then they would look and see, you know, under anesthesia and see that the heart was contracting really well and say, oh, this gorilla heart looks pretty good. What we've since found out is that really gorilla hearts should be a little bit more hyperdynamic, and a normal gorilla, the walls should be slapping against each other. So by the time a gorilla heart looks like a human heart, the animal's ill already. How would you know unless you're actually researching? That's what we do. The other thing that we borrowed from human medicine is this thing called an ILR, implantable loop recorder, and you can tunnel under a tissue and get that close to a heart in humans, and you can record the EKG waves 24 hours a day. And the nice thing about that is that clinical heart disease is usually preceded by, you know, like minute changes in the EKG waves. People sleep at night and have a transmitter in their pillow. It goes to their cardiologist. And as soon as they see that there's a problem, the cardiologist can call the person in and say, hey, let's get you looked at. Let's get you on meds. Let's get you titrated. And then it avoids hospitalization. So we're like, well, let's see if we can do that in gorillas. We tried doing gorillas. We worked again with a cardiologist. But we can't tunnel under the skin and the chest because what do gorillas do, right? They're going to beat their chest or they're going to take the sutures out, right? We found out that gorillas tend not to take sutures out quite as quickly as orangutans. Orangutans are amazing, and they can, like, undo anything you do really quickly. So what we do with orangutans, as a side note, we put decoy sutures in. We put a couple over here, a couple here, you know. So when they wake up, they're like, what the heck, you know? And then they go for some of those. Right? And the other thing, one of the keepers came up was nail polish. So an orang wakes up and it's got pink nails, it's like, and decoy sutures. So it takes, it keeps them busy to get all that stuff off. So, right? Oh my God, my water thing melted. All right, sorry. I'm still going to drink it because I'm thirsty. All right, so. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, yeah. Anyhow, so we want to find out, can we put these ILRs in gorillas? We thought, all right, great, let's put one again, you know, under armpit because they're not going to get groomed out by somebody else, another gorilla. Turns out their body is just too wide. These, I mean, there's, you know, 500 pounds. It was made to go right over a heart, not that far away. So then, we came up with an idea, maybe right over the backbone, a little bit to the side. So we did something called mapping and said, oh yeah, we can fit it in right there and we can tunnel it in, and that way it's going to be really hard to get groomed out. But then the next trick is that in order to get a reading, the gorilla has to hold still for 60 seconds, like hold still. Mm-hmm. And so we're like, well, how do you do that? You talk to the keepers and say, hey, do you think this is something that you could train the gorilla for? Within like a week, it was trained. These two women trained this adult male gorilla just to sit in the back of an exhibit for 2 minutes straight. They can download the information and send it on. So nothing's ever perfect, but the idea is just keep trying and trying and learning and trying to do your best. So this is really cool. Another example is, I wanted to also get to some of the human health stuff too. Another example of something we work on is pandas. Pandas are really smart, and we have a training chute, so pandas can go into this training chute and stick their arm out. They can get their blood drawn. Afterwards, they hold their hands above their head, and they can hold their breath for chest x-rays and then lay down.
Seriously?
Yeah. And then they lay down, and I had pictures that I took out, and then they lay down for an abdominal ultrasound. Like, we can't go in there with them, but we just put our arms in, and we can do that. So one of the things that, this is an example, that panda could not care less. The door is always open, the panda can come in if it wants, but the keepers train these animals to hold still. Here's a vet, just busy drawing blood. So a lot of what we do is made possible by the really unique bond between the keepers and the animals. These guys trust each other so much.
Some animals are more food motivated than the other. What you probably can't see is in the right hand, I think there's a carrot or a pear. So these pandas will just sit there. But it gives us an opportunity to study them and not have to anesthetize them for x-rays or blood work, or if we want to do something like research. One of the and then if we want to do research, we do it with our partners in China, because they're not our animals. They belong to the Chinese people. And that's actually a really important thing with a lot of our wildlife, that it's not ours. If we go to another country, we're really respectful and aware that that elephant belongs to that country and we're there. When I tell people, if a whole bunch of Norwegians came and started doing anesthetizing our squirrels, we'd be like, those are our squirrels. Like, go back to your country, you know? So we have to, you know, these are not our squirrels, is my point. So one of the things we've done, several things, we have tested and validated vaccines with our pandas. The other thing we just are in the process of doing now, along with China, is looking at long-acting antibiotics. A lot of the work we do in the wild, especially in Kenya, you know, people will be, you know, dart an ill or an injured lion, and then we go do our research project, and the vets have to leave the next day to go find the lion and dart it again. And we're like, wow, why don't you use a long-acting antibiotic? It's not as easily transferable from species to species as you might think, depending on how tightly the antibiotic is protein bound. Some species can process it and get rid of it within 2 days, and some species hang on to it for 10 days or 12, which is something we'd want to know. So this, in the case of giant pandas, we injected them with an antibiotic. We bled them 5 times in 1 day, 3 times, 2 times, 1, 1, 1 for the next 2 weeks, and found out that the antibiotic level did indeed maintain the appropriate level for and concentration for most of the pathogens that would affect giant pandas. This is important not only for treating animals in captivity, but if we think in the wild, we have a team of veterinarians right now who are working in China. And as we're releasing pandas into the wild or they come across injured pandas, we'd rather not, and our colleagues, Chinese colleagues, would rather not bring animals into captivity. So that the idea of something's injured, to be able to give it an antibiotic and know it's going to last for 2 weeks, it's a lot easier. That way, you know, you don't have to go check on that animal. All right, so then we think about if we want to take this, so this is what we're doing in terms of research and then how we can affect populations in captivity. But if we want to think more globally, we can also do some things internationally. So our team works internationally all over the place, mostly in Southeast Asia and East Africa. And we work with lowland gorillas and mountain gorillas, cheetahs in East Africa, Namibia. And there's really a lot of different places where there's a need for wildlife veterinarians. And so this is a really great thing. I knew this is what I wanted to do. Was not particularly prepared to have the opportunity to help save or help participate in saving human lives. So these are some women from Turkana, northern Kenya. It's a place that one of the places that we work on human surveillance. As it turns out, and if people who read about emerging infectious diseases, like SARS, Ebola, Nipah virus, the majority of those, about 75% of those viruses come from from zoo animals, wildlife animals, and then spill over into humans. And if we want to make a dent in that, and we can work on some veterinary training and understanding ahead of time, we can theoretically save a lot of lives. We're part of a project funded by USAID called PREDICT. And one of the ideas was, if we were going to try and stop the next major pandemic, how do we do it? And we can't look at every country at all the time. So there was a group of modelers who looked at a number of different data points to figure out where would be the hot zones, where would be the places in the world that, I mean, it'd be great if we could look at everything all at the same time, but we can't. You have to prioritize resources. So this is where the modelers said the hot spots were. So we decided to, so our team works in 32 different countries across these hot spots. And this is what your average, you know, outbreak would look like. At any time in the wildlife population, there are hundreds and thousands of viruses that come and go and get transmitted between wildlife. every now and then there's spillover into the domestic animal population, and we really get in trouble in things like with influenzas or different RNA viruses where that can mutate. And once they're in the human population and can spread from human to human, that's where we're going to lose lots and lots of lives. And if we wait until people, like in Ebola in, 5 years ago, when people start dying to figure out why are they dying, what virus is it, and then build the laboratories then to collect the samples and try and figure out what virus it is, and then backtrack and say, well, where did the virus come from, what species, and then what was the route of transmission, what did people do or what did animals do? We've lost years and years. We've lost, as it turns out, billions of dollars, and most importantly, tens of thousands of human lives. So part of the thinking here is that if we can do some early detection and some early forecasting and develop some of that capacity to understand what kind of viruses are where now, we could, when people start getting sick, we'd be able to say, in this area, these are the viruses that we know are our problems. And we could save a lot of lives and a lot of money, too. And one of the things is that CDC has been working on saving human lives forever, but they haven't had the ability or the capability really to develop that capacity for wildlife feds. So one of the things that's been really needed is that capacity, and there really aren't that many people who are trained in health and disease analysis in all species. When I took the boards, it was 15 years ago, there were only 120 people, boarded zoo vets, on the planet. So that's not much to choose from, and of that, there were only 5 federal vets. You don't have to be federal, it's not all that important, but if you're trying to interdigitate work more closely with other federal agencies, whether it's CDC or USDA, it does help to have that, and that's another great thing about Smithsonian. It can be kind of quasi-federal. We can be federal when it's useful and non-federal when not. For instance, in Myanmar, when the borders were closed for 20 years, our non-federal side was in there working, so when the borders opened up, we can be like, oh, here, we have these great partnerships. And partnerships really do take decades to build. All right, so some of the stuff we do, we build laboratory capacity and we train veterinarians. So we know that we're making a really big impact, and as part of the first 5 years of this PREDICT, our team discovered more than 1,000 novel mammalian viruses. That's a lot. Not all of them are necessarily bad actors, and not all of them are going to kill a whole bunch of people, but that's part of the thing we're trying to figure out. What viruses are there? And then we have teams of, so the modelers help decide where to go. Then we have geneticists look at which are the species that are most likely to transmit something to humans. That's primates and rodents. And then of those viruses, then the virologists rank them and figure out which viral families are the most important. And then of those, we have behavioralists that work with people to figure out, like, what do you do? Like, if we know that bats carry lots of viruses, it's not necessarily eating a bat in a restaurant that's going to be the most dangerous thing because it's cooked by then. It's very often the ladies in the back that are butchering animals without masks or gloves that then go home to kids. So that's part of the trick to figure things out. So as we're figuring things out, we know we're making impact, but part of the idea then is to say, things in Asia are much different. In Africa, as I'm sure all you guys know, in Asia, in terms of disease transmission, the markets tend to be more live animals. People, there's chickens next to birds and civets, and that's a mixing bowl. In Africa, it's more bushmeat trade. Anyways, one of the things that very important, if we're trying to, again, look at this globally, we need to have MDs and DVMs working side by side. In Myanmar, we have our team that's led by an MD and a DVM, so we walk the walk and we talk the talk and make sure that, that we're highlighting both efforts. And we're working to save people and animals because it's very often the same needle, syringe, laboratory, and personnel, whether you're anesthetizing animals to collect samples for the purpose of saving people or for the purpose of saving animals. So that, for me, is the sweet spot that rounds everything out. So I get to go to work. I mean, my goal is to save wildlife, and now I get to work to save people too, which is pretty great, you know. Like, they're one of my favorite species, so that's that works out really well. So that's what we're doing, and then very similar in Africa. So we work with that's one of our lead people in Africa, Matthew Matinda. If anybody ever watches, Smithsonian Channel has this thing called Kenya Diaries, and they follow a wildlife veterinarian along. This is the guy, Matthew Matinda. So we have programs with giraffe and baby rhino, and it's really what we're doing is trying to take the information that we have access to in this country, and which is often a lot broader and than most of the people that we work with internationally have access to. They've got access to the animals, so it's really a nice way for us to share and work together. So we know that we're making an impact. Now the point is, if we want to make an impact, we want to make sure that's sustainable. The way we make sure it's sustainable is by training the next generation. So it can't just be like Norwegians showing up and working on our squirrels and leaving, and it can't be just Americans just showing up, like working on rhinos and splitting. It has to be together, saying like, what are our joint goals and how can we help each other? So in Kenya, just this past year, we've hired two vets, one American and one Kenyan, for 2 years to work side by side together with the idea that both sides have a lot to learn and from each other, and both have a lot to offer. We're also punctuating those 2 years with a stakeholders meeting up front, so everybody, including the Kenyan government and Kenya Wildlife Services, have a chance to say what's important to us, and then we follow up with training programs. So this is it was a orphan baby cheetah, and while an individual might not be all that important, as so many species in the world are declining in the number of species, are declining, you do reach a critical juncture at which the survival of an individual is indeed important. And that's what we can bring by being specialists in zoo animal care. We can go over and train that with our Kenyan colleagues, and then release the animals back into the wild. As this baby was growing up, one of the things they wanted to do was, she goes on walkabouts every day, but they want to have an idea of how far she is going. So we also have GIS personnel. So we have a little collar on her, and they can track and see where she's going. And you never know when that's really going to help another species or another person. If anybody who goes to Kenya, if you do after this, for those who haven't been, this is one of the best hotels around. It's called Giraffe Manor. You can see that a giraffe can kind of stick their heads in. It's not affordable, of course, but it's a great place to go lunch. this is just our team working on anesthetizing a black rhino. They're endangered and they have a particular skin disease. And again, our Kenyan colleagues are really good at getting that dart and getting the animal down. We're a lot better at diagnostics and therapeutics, so that's what we're doing. And then here's two of our fellows working together to help save rhinos in the wild. Again, this is the whole idea of investing the next generation. So part of it is figuring out what needs to get done, what impact can we make. No one can do it all on their own, so the idea of developing really good partnerships, and partnerships in which your first question is, what can I do for you, not what can you do for me. So we have a whole bunch of super great partnerships. And we're also, one of the things that I really like in Kenya is Pam Allen she's created Lit World. And in one of the largest slums in the world, second largest slum in the world, Kibera, is a school which Pam and Lit World has helped to fund and work on. So when I go to Kenya, I tend to go and speak with these girls. And increasingly, it's not just investing in the next generation, but also investing in girls. Bless you. Boys obviously contribute a lot to saving the world, but they tend to have better resources and support systems in place already. There's a whole bunch of really brilliant 10, 11 year, 12 year old girls who are going to be the future leaders that are going to help determine how many kids to have, where the kids go to school, and because of the relationship with Pam, we're now including that in our partnership. The last time I was there in Kenya, 2 times ago, I was asking the kids, what's your favorite animal? And they live a mile from Nairobi National Park, and they're like, the dog. And I'm like, well, what's your second favorite animal? And they're like, the chicken? These young ladies haven't seen elephants and rhinos. I know, crazy, right? Yeah. So what we did just, and I told our chief about this as well. I'm like, so I have a whole bunch of girlfriends at home. I said, every one of you give me $25. I mean, we can all pay for our own, but the entrance and the gas and renting the bus is going to cost $800. You know, everybody give us $25. Pay. We'll all do it together. And then that way we all have, you know, there's a role for everybody. Sometimes it's just listening to a friend speak and saying, oh, that's really cool, and learning. Sometimes it's giving $25, and sometimes it's going to Kenya and staying at the Giraffe Manor. All right, this is the thing that we think will not work. It was a video, so giraffes are really difficult to anesthetize. Years ago, they had about a 30% survival rate. I mean, when these things come down, they're heavy. And this is even in controlled situations in the U.S. We have, again, working with these partners, we have adapted and developed some really, not we, they, but I'm utilizing it too, have developed really good anesthetic protocols. So now the survival rate's up at 90%. One of the things we want to know is like how far where the giraffe go. And they also have a skin illness. So we have taken a biopsy. We've put a little collar on their ossicle so we can see where they're going. Let's see if, not going to work. All right. Then the last thing I'm going to say about connecting and, you know, the importance of connection. As we're going through all this, we're increasingly working with children's hospitals around the country. And one of the reasons for that was years ago, now about 15 years ago, when we had an ill sea lion, this one on the left, Norman. He's about 600 pounds. And he had an asthmatic-like condition, and we needed to nebulize him. So we needed to, you know, have him breathe in tobramycin and albuterol, the same thing that kids do, right? But the zoo didn't have a nebulizer, but my son had asthma, so we called him. It's like, you know, 9 o'clock at night. He's already in his little PJs and asked if we can borrow his nebulizer. So we went home, got him, and that. And the keepers, again, keepers are ingenious. So this is a keeper who trained Norman to breathe from a traffic cone. And then these, hold your breath, breathe out.
So great.
So great, right? Yeah, I mean, like, really brilliant. Another brilliant thing, we had a flamingo with a broken leg, and flamingos only, they have to stay in a flock where they don't eat. You know, it had a KE fixator device on it, and it's supposed to not move. So we had it in the hospital, like, we can't have friends in here because, you know, they're going to move around, and we can't let the flamingo out. So the keepers got a really tall, skinny mirror and put it in the stall with the flamingo. And for 6 weeks, that flamingo ate what its friend ate. It drank when the friend drank, yeah, and just stayed with its, no exercise, just hung out with its friend until it was time to take the KE off and unleash it. So again, it's just like, it's just brilliant stuff, right? And it's brilliant in that it's not that difficult. I mean, you just need to think, and then when someone does it, you're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. So here they are breathing through a traffic cone. And we all thought it was cool. My son never mentioned it again. And about 2 weeks later at a soccer game, and all the dads are over there and all the moms are over here, like, one dad crosses the party lines and comes over and says, reaches across the aisle and says, hey, I wanted to introduce myself and thank you. And he said, my son Declan has asthma, and it was unregulated asthma because he felt so embarrassed about having to take a med every day. And as soon as he heard that Norman the sea lion was taking the same meds, a switch went off, and he felt like, if Norman's doing it, I'll do it too. So there's obviously a lot of lessons here, one of which is that even though my son would never admit it, he actually heard and listened, you know. So he, on some level, he picked that up, and then he thought of it enough to share it with another young boy, who then meant a lot to him. So we've also realized that this is the connection between humans and animals is really important, and this could be a really nice way of depersonalizing disease for little kids. So we're working with Children's Hospital in D.C. and then eventually across the country to work on these photo exhibits and a book and yada, yada. All right, that is it for me. This is my thank you to you guys for having me and then opening up for any questions. So first, let me just say thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Anybody have any questions? Yep.
All right, going back to the cassowary guy. So, what do you think about all of these collectors who have exotic animals that they keep like on their land?
Yeah.
It's not a good idea.
Right. No. It's not good at all. I think that every now and then things work, but every now and then they don't. So whether it's the lady who was attacked by the chimp and lost her face, or it happens. So it's really not a good idea at all, at least from my perspective. I think that if you're not even thinking about disease transmission, there's tons of, like when people go to Nepal and they let a macaque sit on their shoulder, those animals carry a virus called herpes B. It is, if that animal has it, and if it's transmitted to a human, it's about 90% fatal. Not worth it. just like totally not worth it. So, yeah. Yes?
I mean, we all have, probably most of us in the room have domestic animals, right?
Yeah.
We take them in, like, you can't catch this thing that your dog or cat has. But you're talking about how these wild animals have these conditions or diseases that humans could get.
Right.
And so is that something sort of only for the wild animals, and how often does that really happen, or is that like an emerging research area, or is it like a proven thing that these viruses truthfully come from wild animal populations?
It's a proven thing that it comes from wildlife population, and if we had these programs in place 50 years ago, 40 years ago, we wouldn't have HIV/AIDS now. So that's a pretty big thing, if you can think of it. It was like our year, 84, when everybody's trying to figure out why people are dying, if this program had been so. But going back to what I was saying earlier about trying to figure out what the roots of transmission are and what are the species that are most likely to have virus, be able to host viruses that can be transmitted, primates, bats, and rodents. So in general, don't have those as pets, right? Yeah. So, so it'd be very unusual for a dog or cat to have something that a person can get. Although theoretically, some of those things are possible. Like influenza viruses can mutate pretty rapidly, and we did have a situation at the zoo where a keeper was ill, and one of the bears got a bear that was being Andean bear was being hand raised. The bear got sick, and we were able to type it out and find out it was exactly the same influenza. Again, rare, and it's also but it's also not the type that would really expand. And there's charts and maps that showing the frequency with which new diseases are emerging. And it's not like it's more and more common. The rate at which the diseases emerge is increasing. So we're expecting at some point another. And there is another Ebola outbreak now in DRC. Yep.
I'm wondering in your research if you're finding, or you must be finding, how our human society is creating toxic situations that affect
global climate change, right? There's a lot of things that we're all doing that can make the environment affect animal health and human health. So even things like the things that PBBs, whatever, they're in the environment and endocrine disruptors, antibiotics. I mean, antibiotic resistance is a huge deal, an issue for not only people but for wildlife as well. So there's a lot of things that we, as a species, are doing to put other species in peril. That's one of the reasons that the idea of looking at everything holistically is termed One Health. The idea that the environment, human health, and animal health is all really interrelated and linked in such a way that we can no longer take something in isolation and say, what do we need to do to save that elephant needs to be all and both. So the answer is yes, there's a lot of things that people are doing. Fortunately, I think people are becoming a lot more aware and a lot more receptive to hearing the things that we do. Yep.
What was it like to take care of the baby pandas? And also, well, how did you handle all the attention that was put on the zoo and you?
It was a thrill to take care of the baby panda. It's really, I mean, pandas are really super great. And the same thing with a Micronesian kingfisher. When you're holding something like that in your hand, it's a lot of responsibility, but it's also, I mean, like we all go crazy, miss our kids' graduation, book the wrong plane flight, bring four pairs of shoes and the wrong dress, and you just think like, oh my God, is it worth it? And then you do something like that, or you help save a little baby rhino in the wild, and you're like, wow, Yeah, so I think that, it's, from my perspective, it's all worth it, although a couple hours ago, that's not what I was saying. In terms of focusing on attention, I think the media is just terrific, and all of us do really important things, and if you're not sharing the story, does it count? It still counts, but it counts a lot more. That's why I was saying, just everybody does something. Even just by being in this room and listening to me talk, we're all doing something. And I think that the more we can get the story out and let people know we are saving the world, and we can, and you can, and we have the capability and therefore the responsibility, jump on board. Think of something you can do, Dave, to save the world. We're going somewhere with that. And different zoos, I think, have different abilities to deal with the media. I had worked at the Fort Worth Zoo, and they had a great team in terms of training that this is appropriate, this is not inappropriate, this is what you can say. Smithsonian, when I got back there, I was way behind, and I think didn't know how to make the media the friend, and I think that's changed some now. So I think, everybody makes mistakes. We're all going to make mistakes. Things are going to go sour, but the more that we can say, but this is what we're doing, this is the why we did it, and be honest. I think that the media is great. The reason I was calling Dave out when I was saying that, because we were just emailing back and forth about things that people can do to help save species, help save the world. Would you feel like commenting?
I'm in Cleveland, Ohio. And Cleveland, Ohio is right smack in the middle of migratory patterns. And it turns out that leaving lights on in downtown buildings at night during migration from about 11:30 to dawn was causing a huge problem for migrating birds, especially if you had high humidity and low cloud covers. The birds would like insects drawn to your porch light would come in, and rather than continuing the migration, they'd drop down into the city. And then as the lights came on during the day, they would fly and see reflections of trees and in buildings and smack into them. And then rats would come and get them, and seagulls would come and get them. So we started a program, and we've got about 20 buildings signed up, which they will turn off the lights at midnight and not turn them on again until dawn. And it's like, it's such a simple, easy thing to do.
Right.
It's made a big effect.
So I just found out about Dave being involved in that the other day, and I was like, that is great, that's a great example of how there's always something that all of us can do, and it really makes me really so inspired. So, yes.
Are you involved in replenishing populations at all?
Not as much. That's the fun part, and I really like that. That's one of the fun parts. I would really like to be, but I'm also feeling just, too spread out, and I also need to narrow it down. Having said that, some of the work we are doing in China with these Przewalski horses, they had gone extinct in the wild, and they're coming, getting reintroduced. And if the government wants to have an idea of like how much space that these horses are going to need, and so someone needed to, again, since they had those ultra potent narcotics and they're really dangerous to anesthetize, so I was part of a team that went over to go and put anesthetize and put collars on them. The Smithsonian just released a whole bunch of oryx. They had gone also extinct in the wild in Chad. So we are involved in that. And then it's more on the individual level, like, you know, the cheetah and that baby rhino once it gets healthy. So I'm not part of a larger release teams unless something is going ill. It'd be great to do it, you know, be a little bit more preventative. So I'm more on the individual level. But those projects, when things actually go back into the wild, if the land is secured and if that's what the country wants, it's really neat. You've been asked, sorry. Yes.
Two quick questions. A classmate of ours named Chip mentioned that between the student flight and the graduation and all that, that you were honored for conservation efforts in Arizona this week. And I didn't know your work was conservation. That might be completely scurrilous for me, but I wanted you to talk about conservation, and also I just wanted to know, did you get the gallery of $25 donations for the entry to the park for the girls in Kenya?
So, and I think part of the reason that Chip was mentioning that is because I often forget to tell him things. And it's just, and he says the only reason, he's such an introvert, he says the only reason he goes to cocktail parties is to hear where I'm going next. And I'll tell you one funny thing. I met his boss once. I came back from a trip, and I met his boss, and then on the way home from the Christmas party, he said, what'd you think of margaritas? Oh, she's great, but she's kind of weird. She said, you know, sat me down and said, tell me everything there is to know, you know, about Mongolia. And I was like, all right. And I was saying as much as I knew, you know, adding a little bit in. And I said, why do you think she was asking about Mongolia? And he's like, didn't you just get back from Mongolia 2 days ago? I'm like, oh, sorry, no, that was China. Sorry, I know I said Mongolia. I'm like, the Gobi Desert is big, and I just kind of assumed. And he's like, could you at least tell me what country you're in? And I'm like, yeah. So anyways, I forget to mention, yes. So one of the great things, so no one can save the world on their own, right? And conservation, it does not have a lot of money in it. So there is a Swiss bank, UBS, that has decided that they want to be a lot more civic-minded and actually think of what they can do to give back. They've also said that a lot of their high-wealth donors also want to know that they're investing with a bank that's trying to do great things in the world. So that's where I was just a few days ago, giving a talk on these programs. And yeah, so the answer is yes, but thank you for bringing that up. What was your second question? So I actually had the email written, and I have not sent it out. So I felt bad about it. I'm like, oh, I'll just pay it, you know. But if anybody feels like, okay, yes, I would like, yes, I'll just, I mean, right? And the thing is, it could be $10. It doesn't matter. You just, but that way, Venmo. The more people that get involved, it's just, these things have such a ground up effort. Thank you. Yes.
My question touches on money also, particularly money for research. My daughter works for an outfit in Maine, IDEX, which makes veterinary medicines. And they've got a lot of very bright people working for them.
Yes.
But their goal is to develop products that you can sell domestically. I mean, if there's a need to develop new testing for emerging viruses, where does the money come from to fund efforts like that that may not be profitable for a company like IDEX?
Yeah, and it's a problem because that that there never was that much money at any one point. And it's the money that was available has steadily declined over the last 5 years or so, or last 3 years. Our grant through our USAID program, I mean, so USAID was one of the places that would fund it, and we had a consortium of five different organizations led by UC Davis, and they put together a consortium to say pretty much what I showed you. This is where research shows diseases are coming from, and this is the way we can save the world a lot of money. So that was funded for 10 years, but that program's just ending. So it's a really big problem. And a lot of people don't want to give to wildlife because they feel like, well, why should I help save a gorilla when there's people dying? That's a really good argument. So yeah, it is difficult. We do write a lot of grants, and that's the and a lot of our training programs are international training programs where we bring people over from here and then we send people over. It's grant driven, and we'll go after like super small amounts too, where we can just pay for the person's plane flight and the Airbnb while they're here, but. It's, you know, and then we did it the last time too. We paid for the person's air flight, and the girlfriend of mine who has a big house said, "I'll put them up. Let's get the Airbnb." We're like, "Great!" So again, community driven. There's lots of ways to make the world a better place.
I have a second question.
Oh.
You spend a lot of time in Norway because we have four grandchildren.
I meant nothing about the Norwegians and the squirrels.
Norwegians are worried about their squirrels.
I was just trying to pick some random country and some, you know, something that wouldn't be political, you know, like you know, just like no,
political.
Right? Yeah. So I'm like, everybody likes Norway. I'll pick on the Norwegians. Yeah, yeah, but they're not doing anything to our squirrels, as far as I can tell. Yes.
One more quick question. I'm on the board of a wildlife hospital and a volunteer there as well, and we take almost 5,000 to 6,000 wild animals.
Mm-hmm.
Help people learn to live better with wildlife. But it's a very wild and woolly hospital. We did have a vet.
Uh-huh.
But is there any way that your protocols and things that you learn about dealing with wild animals in a setting is shared among these, you know, because these are all very, like, a grassroots types of, you know, they're not interconnected. They're
yeah.
a real vehicle for sharing. And but they're doing really good work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I mean, there's on a broader level, there's something called WDA, Wildlife Disease Association. That's a little bit more geared towards international work, but there's also a lot of, especially around D.C. And even in Vermont too, some really good wildlife places that have protocols. There's Second Chance Wildlife in D.C. And Tufts University has a really good wildlife clinic as well, where they've got tons of protocols written up. So I'd be happy to help you connect, because people tend to share. Great, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. The cassowary. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Do you have an opinion on horse racing?
No, I don't. I never want to see animals get hurt, right? You know, but I also think some horses really love to race. I do think they really love to race, so I watch it. Yeah, I want, you know, I want, yeah, so, yeah. What's your opinion?
I don't have, but I just, you know, there's a growing, there's a groundswell of opposition when you drive past the racetrack, you'll see opposed as fairly
frequently. Yeah, and some tracks are safer than others, and some tracks are not as safe, so I don't know enough to have a strong opinion, other than I love watching those horses run, and I really do think that there's part of them that really does want to win. Yeah. And one other thing, just a side note, people talk a lot about, are animals happy at zoos? And, you know, are elephants in particular happy at zoos? I do have an opinion on that. I think elephants are so, so smart, and I think the people who take care of elephants are really bright as well, and very caring. And at the zoo, well, in the wild, if an elephant has a baby and it's going to go, it needs to take a nap, it's not going to take a nap unless it has an aunt elephant, another female elephant that it trusts that's going to watch the baby. Otherwise, the mom doesn't lay down, and the mom can go weeks without laying down. But in the wild, they have, you know, a matriarchal group, and there are lots of aunt elephants to watch the baby, so it works out very well. At our zoo, Shanti, our oldest elephant, who was on the cover of Amherst magazine. Remember that one? You know, like 15 years ago or whatever? Yeah. She had a baby, and she wouldn't lie down. She didn't lie down for the first couple days, and when the lead keeper was there, she brought her baby over, and as long as Marie stood there, Shanti would lay down and nap. Yeah. So if you think about, you know, what elephants truly love and trust, you know, and then so Marie stayed there a long time so Shanti could get some rest. And then the other thing, when they were out in the yard, elephants also cover up their babies with grass or hay, you know. And so Shanti was out there with her baby Kumari and was covering her up with hay and then looked over at Marie and got some hay and like. Right? So, yeah. All right, I should probably let everybody go. Thank you so much for having me.